You are listening to a Campfire Firecast.
So here we are on the gravel at Halsway Manor, on the edge of Exmoor, one of the most delightful parts of Britain. In May, me and my mate Bruce came for the Blowzabella workshop weekend. Blowzabella have been one of my favourite bands since the 80s. Very hard to describe, although some people might try to label them folk, but that's doing them complete disservice. The workshop weekends bring together a series of ceilidhs, sessions where people have a chance to get together, learn instruments, sing, dance. In fact, 90% of the people there seem to be expert dancers or very accomplished musicians. We met some great people. And I also caught up with my old mate, Paul James, who's really the leader and spokesperson for Blowzabella. We talked about the origins of the band, where they're going, and, whisper it, the cult of Blowzabella. But that's after we discussed the complexities of proper West Country cider, in particular, the afterburn.
The afterburn on it.
It has, yeah.
Which is it's quite complex, isn't it?
The complexities of proper cider, yeah. Talk about that. Should we talk about that instead of blows of breath? So I'm talking to Paul James. I know you can talk for England, so I was just going to ask you about the origins of Blowzabella, really, and how it all came about.
Blowzabella started... There used to be a musical instrument, a famous musical instrument making course at a college called the London College of Furniture and Whitechapel. I think it's now part of London University, and they don't do the instrument making course anymore, which is a bit of a tragedy, because it was had a massively good reputation all over Europe, and loads of really good musical instrument makers were trained there, you know. And I'd come up from Newbury, West Berkshire, where I'm from, and I went to Wimbledon School of Art. My best mate, Alan Lamb, went to London College of Furniture.
Thanks, Alan.
I went to the College of Furniture, and so he was there, and the rest of the people who were in the band at the beginning. So in a way, it started because it was a sort of mad idea to start a sort of drone-based band, mostly around bagpipes and hurdy-gurdies, and because they were making instruments and you couldn't really buy them then. This was in the sort of 76, 77, 78, no, 78. This is in 77, 78, 79. So they just started making them, you know. And it was a bit of a... London was a sort of smaller world before the internet, you know what I mean? And actually it was easy somehow to sort of gravitate towards like-minded people, you know. I mean, I was at art school in the whole sort of punk kind of phase. So, you know, I saw The Clash, you know, at Royal College of Art, you know, because actually punk, for all its pretended working class roots, very much... just like the Beatles came out of art school tradition at Wimbledon School of Art, you know, there were those punks. I was not a punk, but I always really liked that. And actually, Terry Chimes, the first drummer in The Clash.
Tory Crimes.
Yeah, Tory Crimes. He's still going. He played on our second album because, that was kind of a bit punk in the sense that it was a very DIY scene. We were a DIY, mad-sounding folk group and, you know... And everyone says, oh, it's just punk and just people who just play jazz. But actually, everybody... Lowell Coxhill used to sit in with us around a campfire, you know. Everybody used to play with everybody, you know. So it was very much a London thing to start with.
But how did you come to the whole folk thing? Did you grow up with that in the family or...?
Not in the family, but I did kind of grow up with folk music. I started playing... I think me and my sort of oldest friend who I grew up with, Alan Lamb, we were the awkward squad, you know. We didn't like to fit in, so I think we got into folk music just to annoy people, and of course we liked it. I think Alan's dad played us a Johnny Cash record and then a Steely Span album. We thought, oh, that's good. So we got into that. So he would sort of carve lumps of wood into stringed instruments, and I started playing a tin whistle, which I've still got. And we used to listen to like Shirley Collins, you know, Peter Bellamy. You know, all that kind of late 60s, 70s stuff, who are all the generation older than us, but were very influential on us, I think. Especially, I would say, particularly Shirley Collins, who used to play with all that David Munro and the Early Music Consort of London lot, so all the early music, really good early music people, but also the pick of the young guns like Richard Thompson, you know. So you've got this, you know, I think those albums, those late 60s, early 70s albums of Shirley Collins have got a lot to answer for in terms of influencing people, you know. So yeah, I think it's just about trying to be a bit different really and connect with some idea of cultural roots.
And you were saying you were doing a lot of busking at the time as well.
We did, yeah, yeah. And after I joined Blowsbella, me and Cliff Stapleton, the hurdy-gurdy player, we used to... I just left art school and I tried working as a porter in a hospital and van driver and stuff. And me and Cliff realised we could make a lot more money out of busking. So when Covent Garden stopped being a market, proper market, and turned into what it is now, they issued some busking licences and we had very early one, you know, one of the low numbers. We were just happened to be around at the time, so we had a license to play there, and so we did pretty much every single day for about 2 years. Met all kinds. That's where I met Sheila Chandra, actually. It was busking, and then I ended up playing on most of her albums.
And you remember Monsoon, right? Yeah.
I mean, I bumped into her and her then producer Steve Coe, bless him, who passed away not so long ago. And actually, do you know what? About 4 days ago, I was. We're having a little online chat with Sheila. We're still, you know, we're still mates after all these years.
Did you know she came out to Goa with the Big Chill and played our festival out there?
She's great. And she's just sort of something of a writer these days, isn't she? And she lives in Somerset now, over the street, Glastonbury. Right. So we still meet up now and again.
So how's Blowsbella has really evolved over the years, but it's had at its heart, it's had a real sort of spirit of... I don't know, people sort of, it's almost like a cult in some ways, you know, with the dancing.
Yeah.
Just seeing the people dancing here.
Yeah.
I just pick up on the steps, and it's just, yeah. I'm sort of a bystander. I mean, I've loved the music since the 80s, but seeing it evolve now to this point, it's really rich.
Well, we'd been, in the very earliest days of the band, we'd been, there's one festival in particular in a tiny village called Saint-Chartier, where all of more similar and like-minded people used to come together. And the over here, we realised earlier, we used to do Cayleys, you know, for money, and we'd place a load of sort of pissed medical students in London, you know, and ending up in a brawl, you know. and then we went to France, and suddenly realised people just like know 4 or 5 dances, you know, waltz, mazurka, polka, and they just get, there isn't a cool... The worst thing about folk dance music in this country is the caller, because take the ladies onto the floor, you know, left, no sir, the other left, you know, and it's like you can't hear the music. And early on we realised this was utter pain in the arse, and we just wanted to play and people to dance. So we cultivated that sort of more European approach where we just do, if you want, we don't make anybody dance, we don't tell anybody to dance, we do a little bit of calling occasionally just to sort of help people out. We'll do a little bit tonight, but we don't do all that. We just say we're going to play a waltz now. If you know how to waltz. If you don't, it's really simple. Watch people and join in. If you just want to do something else, we don't care as long as you're having a good time. So it's not that sort of Cayley police thing. We don't do that. So in that sense, it's more like a rock gig, because we like to play in standing only venues. We did a concert here last night, which was really nice, to actually play with people sitting down and listening. But generally it's more like a gig in the sense that it's a standing gig with a few chairs and tables, you know. So if you want to come and sit and listen, great. If you want to have a dance, great. If you want to go and heckle, that's fine, you know, it's all good. And we don't patronise the audience by telling them what to do. And there's a lot of that on the folk scene, you know. There's lots of rules, aren't there? Lots of, well, we've just ignored them all.
Good policy.
Worked well for us.
Yeah. I think the second time I saw you live was on the Pyramid stage at Glastonbury. I mean, that wouldn't happen these days with a band like you.
It certainly would not.
Was that through your local Somerset connections that you got that gig?
Well, we were on a bit of a roll. We were doing really massive festivals, you know, like Roskilde and Vancouver and places like this, and main stage at Glastonbury. It was a bit, I think, John Swain being born and bred Somerset, knew Mike Kevis, and Mike was great. I think he'd been to, you know, we'd done a couple of local gigs, something in Glastonbury and Town Hall or something. But it wouldn't happen now, would it? Because we're not corporate enough, you know what I mean? And it isn't, and it is very corporate rock. I mean, to be fair, the main stage of Glastonbury needs to be like that for it to work. And actually, if you go to Glastonbury, all the other stages are still doing really mad stuff, and it's it's still the best festival on the planet, isn't it? And we were very lucky to play there a couple of times, actually. Between New Model Army and Paul Weller.
Is that right?
I mean, how the hell did that happen?
I just remember a lot of mud that year. It was 85, wasn't it? So it was an absolute deluge all weekend. Because we were DJing at the side of the stage when the Pogues were on, we were getting all the flack of the extra mud coming our way.
Happy days.
Yeah. So I've noticed recently, in particular, a lot more jazz influence coming into it. You're wanting to ramp up your sax playing as well.
So. Yeah, I was a bit late start with the saxophone. Very earliest days of the band, we were all in London, and Bill O'Toole, who was one of the founding members of Blows, was Australian and was over doing the instrument thing, of course. So you give shelter to one Australian, and all the others turn up and come stay in your flat. So we had Lindsay Pollock, who's still a very well-known and influential world music guy. He came over and he played a little curved soprano, and I've got one with me this weekend, and was playing a lot of Balkan music and Balkan kind of Balkan gypsy music and that sort of thing. And Lindsay, we played with Lindsay a bit, and he's very influential. And also the late, great Lowell Coxhill, who is an absolute legend, I think. And he said, "Oh, you want to play the saxophone? Oh, you like playing it?" He let me have a go on his little curved soprano, and then he told me which one to get. He said, "Don't buy that one, it's far too expensive. Go into Bill Lewington's and buy one of these." So I did, like the next week or something. And thanks to Lowell and Lowell Coxhill and Lindsay Pollock, that's what got me started. You know. But I'd always listened to a lot of jazz. When I was doing A-level art, we had a art teacher who was massively into bebop, and he had a beautiful, proper old-fashioned, heavy-duty turntable and lovely Wharfdale speakers in the art scene. He just used to play. He said, "You're not going to like this, but you're doing a two-year A-level course, and I'm going to play quality jazz at you every time we have an art class." And that's why I love John Coltrane.
So these Blows of Bella weekends, how long have they been going?
I organised the first one in 1984, and why was because somebody just asked me this a minute ago, actually, was because I think I realised that all our audience, even earlier, we were playing slightly old music, but there was nowhere to learn it, teach it, you know. And I thought, well, if we do, they're going to love it, you know. So we realised that a lot of the audience, they either sing, dance or play. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. And if we just started doing workshops and just, you know, showing them the dances, playing music with them, that would be a good thing. And it's absolutely been... So it's always been this sort of educational side, I suppose, really, but it's absolutely paid dividends. I honestly don't know why more bands don't do it, because that, I think, was very... you've got to be a good live act, but that was fundamental, I think, to our longevity, because you build up this sort of quite intense relationship with the audience, and they go on and they form their own bands, and they do this, that and the other. So it sort of, in a way, spawned a little scene, you know, which has been great for us, hasn't it?
It's amazing being in there, because there must have been, 40 or more players in there, seeming like 80%, 90% of the people here are players or dancers, and it's great to have that level of engagement.
Yeah, I did a big band workshop, so I mean, about 40, 45 people, big sound. It was, yes, and all, you know, really nice people, very positive, and just want, you know, it's not, these workshops, it's not about being great at it, it's just trying to get them to express themselves and enjoy it, really.
Community spirit, really.
Absolutely.
Campfire remix, actually, with some circle singing. Tobias Hugger used to be in the Swingles Singers. He's very influenced by Bobby McFerrin, and he just started spontaneously some circle singing. Then I went and remixed it. We had three producers who sort of handed it on, and people phoning in their parts. And we've constructed a track through phoned in parts, plus the original slightly dubious audio quality recording, and I love that sense of DIY coming back to what you're saying.
I live in a place called Inkpen between near Hungerford and Newbury, but in Newbury there's a great little volunteer art centre called the A Space. It's all just run by volunteers, and every first Friday of the month they have a open mic. You have to phone up Tuesday to get on Friday. It's so popular, and I was in there a few months back, and I was sitting next to somebody, and I thought, oh, he's kind of recognise you. She said, and it was Melinda Messenger. She just lives around there. So, well, why are you here then? She said, oh, my daughter's going to get up and do so. There was everything from her 17-year-old daughter to really, really old folkies and everybody in between. Why? Because they get fed up with X Factor in the end, isn't it? There's just something about being in a space with other people singing or playing that's never going to go out of fashion, and also is impossible to take over through by all the corporations. You know, they would love to get, they'd love to bottle that and sell it, but you can't. You've got to be there.
So in terms of Blowsabella's material, I mean, I think I remember you saying in the very early days you always looked south and east for your inspiration. Really, there's a lot of Celtic stuff going on, but you looked into Europe and the Balkans, and that's where your sound fundamentally comes from. What's the process of getting new tunes together? How did they evolve?
Well, we did do that, and then I think we got fed up playing other people's music, and also just we in the 80s particularly, we just gigged too much, like a lot of bands do, you know, too much, and you just get fed up with the stuff you're playing. And so in about 86-87 we started writing tunes, and then he's written a tune, I wonder if I could write a tune, you know. And then, and so fast forward into say about 2004-05 and actually 90. In fact, funnily enough, just the last couple of years we started playing traditional folk music again. But it's kind of 90% of what we play we've composed, but we got the idea from playing lots of other kind of music, and that's sort of inspiring you and helping you to understand the different rhythms, you know, 3-4 and music and 5 and, you know, 1-2-3, 1-2-1, 2-3, 1 or 7, you know. You know, so you find a lot in the Balkans, and then that inspires you to write music. And we've just, because we've been going a long time, I hopefully just got better at that. So now it's all up to the writing, and everybody in the band actually does write tunes, some more prolific than others. How the process of watching gets selected, none of us could explain to you, but let me say, we've all felt the tumbleweed moment in a rehearsal. We said, I've got a really nice tune I'm going to play you, and then everyone's kind of going, really? That? It's quite brutal. But the good stuff rises to the surface. So for every tune we've played, there's been 3 or 4 we haven't. You know what I mean? It didn't make the cut. But how that happens is hard to explain.
You've thrown in some interesting curveballs along the way, like your cover of The Violent Femmes, which was in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah. They're back out gigging, aren't they? Yeah, and they were great to us. They, you know, they got in touch and really liked the version we did. And we'd done all kinds of things. But I think that was the, you know, every album we did was kind of different. I think we were experimenting and trying to find our voice. And by the end of the 80s, I think we had, which is, you know, a band that loves British and European traditional music, but mostly writes its own material, or tries to do interesting arrangements of traditional music and songs. You know, if we're going to do a folk song, well, I don't know what a recreation of the tradition would be. I mean, I wasn't there in 1850, so who the fuck knows, you know. So, you know, so we just, if we take an old song, we'll just try and make it sound kind of like Blowsabella would do it, you know. So we get in a room and we rehearse, and we kind of try ideas out and arrangements and horn section parts and riffs and harmonies, and then kind of through a sort of process of reductive process, I suppose, we discard things until we end up with something, and we kind of go, yes, that's how it should be. But funnily enough, as somebody is, as you rightly said, he could talk for England. Funnily enough, when I'm in music, I barely speak. Guess it's all about the music.
let the music do the talking. So you seem busier than for a long time at the moment. Yeah. Where next for Blazer Bay?
Well, it's a good question. We thought we'd get the Stops out because just to celebrate the fact that the band started in 1978. I mean, it's a very different band now, mostly different people, and you know, it's been a long journey, and not everybody made it. You know, Dave Roberts, our first great accordion player, died in the 90s. He had an undiagnosed heart defect. And Ian Luff, bless him, bass player, second player, sort of lost his battle with his demons, you know, last year. It was very sad. And actually, our longtime producer in the 80s, Charlie Gray, I only found out about a month ago. We hadn't heard from him in years. We always thought he's either in prison or he's dead. He's dead, basically. Again, a great, very talented guy. Lots of demons. We did some mad stuff with Charlie, you know. So, you know, we didn't, you know, not everybody's still standing. You know, one of the original members, very bad, been sectioned at times and had very bad mental health problems. And, you know, so it's a typical band. It's a bit like a family, you know, and some of it's not been great and a lot of it has been great. And so we're all still standing and we're still playing. So what's next? Well, you know what? We're just going to keep... It's all about... If we can keep coming up with the tunes, we'll keep going. I think if we dry up creatively, we'll all know that it's time to knock it on the head. But at the moment, there's no danger of that. But who knows?
Certainly to my ears, it sounds fresher and more vital than ever.
Thank you.
Yeah. So anything else you want to say?
No. If you want to find out about, because the band does have this kind of interesting history, really. But we've just done a new website, which is inevitably called Blozabella. If you just Google Blozabella, you'll find it. Blozabella.co.uk. But I've started a kind of history page on it where you can read the whole story from beginning to end. And actually, what I wanted to say was that around when the band beginning, not everyone's got a camera on their phone now. I've taken probably 500 photos already this weekend. You know. How many will I use? Two. But in those, nobody had a camera. So if anybody out there's got an old cassette bootleg, don't worry, send it. We won't. We like bootlegs. Or some, doesn't matter how out of focus, photos. Did send us it in, because we'd like to put it on our website.
I finally got you a high-res version of the Glastonbury picture.
Thank you, because I'd forgotten you'd taken that, because you were DJing.
We were at the side of the stage.
Yeah, that was great. And thanks for that, because that's the only extant photo, the proof that we actually played on the Pyramid stage. You know. Yeah. And Charlie Gray was out mixing out front that night.
Yeah, I remember Charlie. Didn't he live in Crouch End?
He did, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Paul. Thanks very much.
Yeah, cheers, Pete. Cheers. Good luck with the convention. We do follow it online. It's great.
Good, thanks.
Listening to a Campfire Firecast.